Welcome to this podcast from Christ Church London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
So we are in week three of this series looking at the Gospels, and just to kind of backtrack a little bit. Week one, we looked at a lot of the historical background to the Gospels, and we asked what was the world like at the time of the birth of Jesus. We looked at the Roman Empire. We looked a bit about what Judaism would have been like, and we'll pick up some more of those themes as we go along. But then we use some of that knowledge to help us to reread the Christmas stories in Matthew and Luke. Last week, if you were here, we asked the question, which arguably we should have asked in week one, which is, what on earth are Gospels anyway? What is the genre that we are reading and dealing with when we come to the Gospels? And what are the particular difficulties or challenges that face us as we try to read them? And how should we therefore try and read them well? And I suggested a number of different ways. And then we did some group work at the end, and I asked you in a slightly disheartening moment, how did you find it? And almost everyone said hard, and I suddenly thought, oh gosh, this is going to be a painful end to the seminar. But actually, all of you got it. And when we went around and we looked at these different passages and you applied some of the tools, you drew out some really fascinating and I think very helpful things from the Gospel accounts that I was really encouraged by. And I hope that even though it did feel maybe hard at first, I hope that you feel like maybe you've learned a few skills to be able to help you to understand the Gospels a little bit more. One of the things I argued last week is that when approaching the Gospels, there are loads of different ways of thinking about it. What I find helpful is Richard Hayes' description, which we looked at last week, about the various different levels of task, beginning with the descriptive task. That is, looking at any passage and any Gospel in its own right, as it were. So you read a passage in Matthew's Gospel, for example, read it first in the context of Matthew's letter, asking you questions about Matthew's own purpose, Matthew's own agenda, what Matthew is trying to say, and how does this fit within Matthew's overall picture of the Gospels. I said we've got to start there, the descriptive task, before we move on to the second task, which is very important, which is the synthetic task, which is to say, okay, I see how Matthew is saying these particular things and why he has arranged this in a particular way, but how does that then fit with what I know about Mark and Luke and John, and in fact, wider than that, with the whole New Testament and the whole Old Testament and, you know, everything in the world? How do we kind of synthesize this with the rest of the Bible and with what we know about God? And that, I think, needs to be the second part of the task. We need to get there, otherwise we will never have a full view of God and of what he wants to reveal and teach us through his word. But if we run straight to synthesizing and saying, yeah, but what did Jesus say in all the Gospels about the law or the temple or the kingdom or whatever, which we will get to next term, if we run there straight away, I think we will miss some of the particular nuances that come by looking at each voice in turn. And the danger is that we might actually end up skewing or changing or misreading what the original authors were trying to say. And the image that I found very helpful, which I suggested last week, is actually it comes from Ben Witherington and his book on ethics, which is enormous. This came in chapter one, which is the bit I've read. He said, imagine an orchestra who are putting together a beautiful piece. It requires each member, first of all, to learn their own line, to be able to practice and practice and practice and know what they are meant to be playing. And if you rush to actually putting the whole orchestra together too early, you will end up with a sound that is far less than the author intended, and it won't be very pleasant at all. But the opposite is also true. If you only stick with people learning their own lines and you never bring them together, you miss the whole beauty of what the composer intended. So we need to start with the descriptive task before moving to the synthetic task. And we looked at that a bit last week. And what I want to do over this week and then next week is do some of that kind of descriptive task work. We're going to look today at Matthew and Mark and ask a couple of particular questions about what their purpose is, why they have written the way they have. And then next week we'll do the same with Luke and John. And hopefully this will give you a good framework for being able to read the Gospels for yourself. And then next term we'll come to some of the more synthetic stuff. We will look at the parables in depth. We will look at Jesus teaching on the Torah, the law, on the kingdom. We'll look at all sorts of different things, miracles, Jesus' death, Jesus' resurrection, all that sort of stuff. But today, Matthew, Mark, next week, Luke and John. And what I want to do really is swap the order around and actually start with the group work this week and kind of get you to look at some of the Gospels, do an exercise, think through a little bit about what the Gospel writers are trying to say in these particular passages we'll look at, and then we'll feed it back and we'll try and get a bit of a biography of Matthew and what he's saying about Jesus, and then the same for Mark. So what I'd like to do is this. I'd like to split you down the middle. Let's go right here. Yeah, don't take it too personally. No, do. Right down, no, that's a joke. Right up there, and on this side, we're going to have the Matthew crew. On this side, we're going to have the Mark crew. And in a moment, I'm going to split you up into those groups, and you can get into groups of maybe four or five within your different gospel. And we'll set each of you some tasks. I'll explain about the notes in just a second. But essentially, what I want you to do is I've set each of you a task that will help you to think about the particular structure and nuances of each of the Gospels that you've been given, and it'll give you some Old Testament references to look at as well. And I want you to think about these two questions. According to the author that I have, whether it's Matthew or Mark, who is the Christ? Namely, what is the picture of Jesus that this author is trying to get me to see? What is the way that this author, Matthew or Mark, is particularly... what is he particularly trying to draw out of Jesus? How is he painting him in order us to see him in a new light? That's the first question. Who is the Christ? Second is this. What is the crisis? And there's a nice bit of alliteration there. Who is the Christ? What is the crisis? Namely, what has Jesus come to do, or what problem has Jesus come to alleviate? And again, I think we'll see that it's slightly different in Matthew and Mark. So who is the Christ? What is the crisis? On page 2, we have the exercise, which is for the Matthew crew. So in just a moment, when we break you down, I'd like you to do the exercise on there. On page... 6, we have the exercise that is for the Mark crew, and I'd like you to do that. I'll come and sort of talk through and just check you're okay. It should be fairly self-explanatory what we're asking you to do, and then we'll come back and we'll feedback and see where you've got to. Okay, so Matthew, Mark, let's give you 10 minutes and see how you get on. Okay, great. How did you find that? Hard. Christian found it hard. Anyone else find it hard? Okay, bear in mind, part of the reason you may find it hard is that I might have just phrased the exercise very badly, so that may reflect more on my teaching skills than on your Bible reading skills. And take heart, I honestly mean it. Last week you said you found it hard, and you got exactly the answers I'm after, so I'm sure we will get there today as well. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to now look at each of those Gospels in turn, and of course Matthew guys, remember that Mark guys won't have read the passages that you've read, and vice versa. And so I'm going to just give you a couple of facts about Matthew, and then I'd like to hear what you found from that particular exercise. We'll start with you guys. And then I want to widen out, and I'll teach a little bit more about Matthew, and then we'll do the same for Mark in a minute. And Andy Tuck is going to lead the Mark guys through your exercise. Okay, well, let's start with Matthew. Just a couple of comments to set the scene. Matthew is often described as the most Jewish gospel for a number of reasons, mainly to do with his attention to detail about Jewish customs, his teaching on ethics, his focus on the law, his criticism of the Jewish leaders, and his regular reference to the Old Testament scriptures. If you go through Matthew time and time again, you will see phrases like, this was done in order to fulfill X, far more than in the other gospels. And so Matthew is often thought of as being a particularly Jewish gospel, perhaps written to Jewish Christians, or maybe Christians who are living in areas with a large Jewish population. Possible areas are maybe Syria, maybe Palestine. It's hard to work out exactly where it's been written to, somewhere around there. And the purpose seems to be to help Jewish people to see Jesus as the fulfillment of the Old Testament and to give them an ethical framework for how to understand God's purposes and how to live a life in the new kingdom of God. And we'll come back to the kingdom idea on another week. But a large amount of Matthew's gospel is given over to sustained blocks of Jesus' teaching. There are huge sections where, rather than doing things, Matthew's Jesus is explaining things. He is unpacking things. He is helping people to understand particular aspects of the law or God's purpose or whatever. There's a lot of teaching in Matthew's gospel. Okay. The task that I set you, Mark, guys, it's on page 2, I think, of the notes, was to look at a number of Old Testament passages and to compare them with a number of passages in Matthew. Give me some just, you know, gut reactions. What was your feeling when you read those passages before we actually look at what they said? What do you notice?
A lot of parallels.
First one being
killed, Jesus' claim, like, when being born, the
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so the Mark guys won't yet know what stories I'd given you in the Old Testament. So a lot of parallels between Jesus' story and which story? Yeah, and the Moses story, you said. Yeah. Okay, great. So Matthew seems to be trying to draw some kind of link between the events of Jesus' life and the Moses story. All right, let's tease that out a little bit. So what did you see in the first two passages when you compared those? Yep.
Yep.
Yep, great. Okay, so in both passages, in both passages you've got an evil king who is slaughtering children, particularly the eldest male child, yep, and the child survives, yeah? The child is saved from the murderous plans of an evil king. Great. Sure. So it seems to be a deliberate plan to remove any possible heir to the throne, any possible rival king. And knowing what we learned about Herod in week one, that he was essentially a homicidal maniac who killed anyone that got in his way, whether it was kids or, you know, his wife or whatever, that kind of rings true with what we know about this guy. You know, terrified, just megalomaniac of a man who was worried about anyone who would pose a threat to him, including this tiny baby who can not yet speak or walk or anything. Yeah, okay, so box one, child saved from an evil king who is slaughtering children. What was the second set of passages? Anyone? Any?
We've got written down Sojourner to a Foreign
Land. Okay.
I can't remember what it was about.
Right. I'll give you a clue. It's about them moving to a foreign land. Yeah. You're on it. Okay. In both passages, we find that this child flees for his life and has to live in a foreign land. Yeah. That simple. I'm not, you know, maybe we were overthinking it a little bit. That's basically what I want you to get. And third set of passages, what happens?
Moses encounters the burning bush. God tells him to go back and deliver his people from Pharaoh.
Yep.
In the Matthew passage, Joseph has a vision by an angel.
Yep. Great. Yeah. So in both passages, there's this some kind of divine encounter which results in them going back after the death of this evil king. Yeah. Brilliant. Next. Fourth one down. Any similarities there? Yep. Great. Yeah, so in Exodus, Israel, the whole people, are declared to be the Son of God. Yeah. And in Matthew, Jesus, one person, is declared to be the Son of God. Interesting. Hold that thought, and we'll come to why that might be in a moment. Fifth one down. What's the similarity there? You didn't get to the fifth one. Did anyone get to the fifth one? Wilderness. For how long? Okay, interesting. So in the Moses story, they are in the wilderness for 40 years. In Jesus' story, they are in the he is in the desert for 40 days. Okay, again, let's hold that thought for a moment. And the final one, if anyone got there, what happens? Exodus 19 and Matthew 5. Two mountains. Yep. What in the New Testament? Sermon on the Mount. Yeah. Perfect. Great. You got that as well. Okay, so two mountaintop scenarios in which this figure delivers significant teaching. Old Testament, it's the Ten Commandments. New Testament, it is the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, now, what do you think Matthew might be trying to say by framing the Jesus story in this particular way? Any ideas? Okay, so some kind of link between the experiences of Israel's past and the future, yeah? More specific than that, even. Which is obviously a great point, but that's a preacher's point, isn't it? That's a kind of, I want to make this relevant to everyone. Let's go, like, ultra-specific. What is Matthew saying about Jesus?
Well, like, it's a story within a Jewish context. Is their thing is this is how we work second.
Yep.
Story. So kind of by telling Jesus' story in a similar way, that this is the way that everyone's going to be saved.
Great, yes. Brilliant. So the answer there, which is true of your answer as well, actually, is that in the past, this was not only a good story, this was the archetypal story of God delivering his people. And so framing the Jesus story in the same way gives a hint that Matthew is saying, this is the great Exodus. This is the great salvation. And I think Jesus, to answer that, who is the Christ question, I think Jesus in Matthew's gospel is deliberately being portrayed as the new Moses. I think that is what Matthew wants to bring out. Jesus is the new Moses. And people would talk about Moses as being this great leader. They would talk about this one who is to come, who will be a prophet like Moses. And they're saying, actually, no, Jesus is not only a prophet like Moses, as in, like, you know, Moses was this great guy and Jesus aspired to be like him. No. Jesus is the new Moses. He is greater than Moses. And he is going to achieve on a grander scale what Moses achieved for Israel back in those passages. Let me illustrate this a little bit further. Turn to the next page. Let's read Matthew 2, verses 13 to 18 very quickly. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and he took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." We'll come back to that quote in a moment. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that had been ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they care no more. And in this story, I think if you are well-versed in your Old Testament narrative, if you know the story of Moses as being like one of the absolute bedrocks of your faith, as Simon said this morning, if you were here, you know, these are our people, this is our story. If you're living in that world, in that country, as he put it today, then you would read the Matthew story and think, that reminds me of something. Look at the arrows across the top. In both passages, a child is saved from an evil king intent on slaughtering children. He flees for his life and has to live in a foreign land, namely Egypt. He returns after the death of the king. There seems to be this parallel between Moses and Jesus. And I think Matthew is drawing those things out for a good reason. Now, just to be clear, and this is something I argued in previous weeks, and I just want to make it clear again today, I am not saying that Matthew thought, how can I make Jesus seem like Moses? Let's make up stuff about him. I'm not saying that at all. I think these things are only of any benefit to us at all if they actually happened. Otherwise, just, you know, put them on the shelf alongside Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and whatever. Good stories, but nothing more. I think these are things that actually happened, but Matthew, like a master director or like a master composer, is taking all the elements at his disposal and saying, how can I arrange these with a particular purpose in mind to show that Jesus is the new Moses who has come to bring new exodus, a new restoration, a new promised land for his people on a bigger scale than even our forefather Moses has. That's, I think, what Matthew is doing here with this passage. But then I think we've got to ask a number of questions about what is going on in a passage like this. And last week, one of the things I encouraged you to do was to look at, whenever you come across a quotation, look at it and say, all right, why is that being quoted? And not only to say, why is that one verse being quoted, but why is that verse in its original context being quoted? So if someone has a Bible, you may want to open it to chapter 11. Let me just read it here. In Matthew, it says, "This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet," that is Hosea, "out of Egypt I called my son." That sounds great, okay? If I were to ask you, without looking at the rest of the passage, how does Jesus fulfill Hosea 11:1? I imagine it'd be fairly easy to answer that question. How does Jesus fulfill Hosea 11:1?
He went to Egypt and then
Great. He went to Egypt. God called him out of it. Nice and simple, right?
Yeah.
Great. Now, can someone read to me Hosea 11, verses 1 and 2?
When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son.
Great.
But the more I called Israel, the further they went from me.
Not so great. Okay, keep reading, actually. Read the next verse.
They sacrificed to Baal, and they burned incense to images.
Okay, so that's not great at all, is it? So we get this verse where Matthew's like, this is Jesus. This was talking about Jesus. Isn't it great? And then you read the rest of the context, and you think, what are you really saying? That every time God tried to woo Jesus, he went further away? He sacrificed to false gods? Is that what's going on here? Or is Matthew just playing fast and loose and doing that kind of preacher trick we mentioned last week, which is just quote the verse that's nice and then move on and hope no one notices, which, of course, we never, ever do here. You're not meant to laugh at that. You're meant to go, yes, you're right. What is going on here? Any thoughts?
Well, if you look back at the Exodus chapter where it says, I've called Israel my son out of Egypt, he's still referring to them here, also in Hosea, but with the future prophecy towards the Christ also being called out of
Egypt. Great. Okay, so the link there is that idea that in the Old Testament narrative, Israel is called my son. In the New Testament, in Matthew, Jesus is called my son. And I think that what Matthew is doing here is saying that Jesus somehow embodies Israel. He becomes the embodiment of the people of God, in a sense. And what Matthew is saying here is not that, and Jesus did everything that Israel did, as in sacrifice to Baal, etc., etc., but rather, as the epitome, as the prime example of God's son, Jesus did what Israel could never do. Jesus lived in the way that Israel was always designed to live, but had never managed to live up to. So, Old Testament, you've got God saying to this people, you are my son, I love you, I'm investing in you, I've got promises for you, I'm going to guide you, just stay faithful to me. And what do? They do exactly the opposite, and they start worshipping other gods. Now, Matthew is saying, you've got a new son of God, the one who comes as the embodiment, the representative of the whole nation. And whereas Israel lived like Hosea 11, 2, 3, and so on, Jesus didn't. Jesus didn't. So when you look at the passage in context, you realize that Matthew is not just picking it out of context for no real reason or because he doesn't know what to do with the rest of the passage. He's making a clear point. Jesus succeeds where Israel failed. Let's look at another passage that's also quoted in here. At the very bottom, verse 18, Matthew quotes Jeremiah 31, verse 15. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they care no more.
Is that right?
Oh, sorry, that's a typo. You are probably correct. Sorry. Forgive my typo. Why is Matthew quoting this particular verse? Now, we won't have time to look at it, but I think a good principle, as I've already said, is when you see a verse quoted, don't simply go, what does that one verse mean? But say, what does that mean in its context? Go back to the passage, read the whole thing. And I think, and we don't have time to look at it now, but I'll just leave it out there and you can look at it yourself. I think the reason that Matthew has quoted this verse is because he understands that within the wider context of Jeremiah 31, Jeremiah is prophesying about something that all comes to fulfillment in Jesus. And without writing out the entire passage and going, and Jesus fulfilled that and that and that and that and that and that and that. He wants biblically literate people to go, oh, I get what's going on there. Go back to the old passage and see for themselves just how incredible Jesus is. And so if you were to look at Jeremiah 31, you would find that mourning women operate like a symbol of the hope of God that is to come. And in Jeremiah 31 and in other parts of the Old Testament as well, mourning women typically precede three things. One, deliverance from God. That is God delivering you, not deliverance away from God. Deliverance that comes from God. Two, the return from exile. And three, new covenant. And if you read Jeremiah 31, that seems to be the promise. God will rescue you. There's mourning and weeping now, but God will rescue you. He will bring you back to your land and he will give you a new covenant. And right at the beginning of the Matthew story, Matthew seems to say, hey, there is weeping now. There are people weeping, mourning this loss. But no, God has promised, Jeremiah 31, that mourning women precede deliverance from God that comes through the Messiah, Jesus. He promised a return from exile, which is greater than you have even dreamed of. It's bigger, far bigger than simply getting back to a tiny little strip of land in the Middle East. And he promises to bring new covenant, which, of course, then you get to Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and you just find that's all over the place. So Matthew is using this as a symbol of the hope that is to come. What does this tell us about Matthew's hermeneutic, that is his approach to interpreting Scripture? Well, I think Matthew sees Jesus clearly as the fulfillment of Scripture, not just in a basic sort of prophetic sense, like this prophecy refers to him, and that's as simple as it is, but rather the whole story of Scripture comes to its fulfillment in the person of Jesus and what he has come to do. I think Matthew is trying to tell us here very clearly that Jesus is the new Moses come to bring deliverance to his people. I'm running out of time. I'm going to steal Tuck's time if I'm not careful. But just very, very quickly, move to the next slide and I'll just show you this and then we will move on. One final way that I think Matthew shows this, and of course there's way more that we could look at if we had time, and we'll get to some of the particularities of Matthew's gospel as we go through the rest of the course. But just to show you this, one bit at the end of the gospel, which I think, again, seals this sense of Jesus being the new Moses. If you compare Deuteronomy 31 with the Grand Commission in Matthew 28, we see a number of different parallels. Deuteronomy 31. The Lord has said to me, you shall not go over this Jordan. The Lord your God himself will go over before you. He will destroy these nations before you so that you shall dispossess them, and Joshua will go over at your head as the Lord has spoken. And the Lord will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and to their land when he destroyed them. And the Lord will give them over to you, and you shall do to them according to the whole commandment that I have commanded you. Be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Then Moses summoned Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you shall go with this people into the land that the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall put them in possession of it. It is the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Now, if you're familiar with Matthew's gospel, even just reading that then, there may be phrases that leap out to you and you think, I've heard that somewhere before. I recognize that. Well, if you're to read the very final passage in Matthew, the Great Commission, it says this. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. Do you spot any similarities between those passages? Here are the ones that I think are most pertinent. Both of them take place on a mountain. And in both Deuteronomy and Matthew, you get a mountaintop commission. In Deuteronomy, they are told to take the land. In Matthew, they are told to go to the nations. In Deuteronomy, they are told to do all that I have commanded. In Matthew, they're told to teach all that I have commanded. In Deuteronomy, Joshua is the one who will go over. In Matthew, Jesus, his name is Yeshua. It is Joshua, which means God is salvation. In Deuteronomy, and in fact both of them, we are told the Lord himself will go before you. And in both passages, we are told God will never leave you or forsake you. Now again, I'm saying this is, Jesus literally taught this stuff. Jesus literally said this stuff. And Matthew is crafting this as a way of saying, you know, we end this gospel with a mosaic vision of this sort of new world looming and the promise that we can go in and take it. We are commissioned and promised that God will go before us. He will never leave us. And this is like that new Exodus moment, walking forth into the promised land. And Matthew leaves us kind of with this tantalizing cliff edge of what happens next. And that's what we're meant to feel as we now try and do Christian life, as we try and follow Jesus, living out this commission in Matthew 28. Does that make sense? All right, there's tons more I could say on that. And we'll come to questions in a bit, because you may have a ton of questions about that. But I want to get Andy Tuck to talk through the Mark crowd as well. So would you please welcome to the stage my favourite theologian at Christchurch London, Andy Tuck.
Great. Thanks, Liam. Thanks for that warm welcome, guys. So it's my job in the next 20 minutes to take you through Mark and sort of the exercises that we did there. Firstly, let me say, hasn't this series been wonderful? Just as kind of we've explored some of the tools and structures that we can use to get our hands on the Word of God. If you were here listening to Simon Ponsonby in the early service, talking all about the Word of God and how we shouldn't neglect it. And I love the fact that this is what we're doing together now, wrestling with Scripture, seeking answers within it, questioning it, and going after truth within it. And I hope that I'll be able to do that just through Mark's Gospel with you guys now and actually inspire you guys to get your hands on Mark's Gospel and to go through it and uncover just so many of the treasures that are lying in wait for you in its pages. Before we go through the exercise together, let me just go through the overview of Mark's Gospel that you'll find in your handout. So let's just review kind of what we're thinking about when we talk about Mark. Get that Matthew stuff out of your head. Let's concentrate on Mark's Gospel. All right. So, firstly, just a bit about Mark and its author. So, Mark's Gospel, this is the first Gospel that we believe to be written, the earliest of the four accounts. And it was written for a Gentile audience. So, very, compared to Matthew, which is for a Jewish audience, this is very clearly for a Gentile audience. Not only does Mark just not quote the Old Testament as much, but he also translates Aramaic phrases. He explains Jewish customs to people that would obviously be unaware of what they were and their symbolism. From the early church fathers, we learn that Mark is not an eyewitness himself. He didn't experience these events, but rather was Peter's interpreter, is the phrase that they use consistently. And we know from elsewhere in the New Testament that Peter seems to have had a really close relationship with Mark. So there's that reference there from Peter's letter, 1 Peter 5:13, where he calls Mark my son. These guys were close together. They were tight. There's also some really intriguing internal evidence that we can look at that kind of seems to indicate that Peter is the authority behind Mark's gospel. So on the handout, what we've got there is a comparison of Peter's proclamation of the gospel in Acts 10 alongside a rough structure of Mark's gospel. And you'll see remarkable correlations as they work their way through. What's this nice about this as well is it helps us kind of see that both Luke and Mark would have had Peter as the authority behind both of those things. There was a common man behind both statements. Encourage you guys to look through that in your own time. It's a really cool study to do and to look at those. But on towards the exercise. Now, I must admit that Mark's Gospel is probably my favourite Gospel of all of them, possibly because it's the shortest, but it's also the punchiest. Actually, it contains my favourite verse in the Bible as well. I think as you read through Mark's Gospel, you see that he just cleverly weaves through themes that really help us explore Jesus' central question that he poses in Mark 8:29, where he says, "But what about you? Who do you say that I am?" And while Mark is clever, he's also very blunt. He's proper up front with how he thinks that we should answer Jesus' question. So if you look at the first verse of Mark's Gospel, Mark 1:1, he says this, "The beginning of the Gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Bam, right up front, this is who Jesus is. This is the good news that I'm proclaiming to you, that Jesus, who you've heard about, is the Christ and is the Son of God. And this exploration of Jesus' identity is fundamental to Mark's gospel. And hopefully you found the exercises for those guys that did it. Hopefully you found the exercises helpful just to explore how Mark is pointing us towards that right direction, who is Jesus. So if you turn over your page on the handout, we'll explore the exercise together. Now, it's worth noting that Mark is a bit more complicated in terms of he isn't as simple as Matthew and Luke in proclaiming who Jesus is. So with Matthew's Gospels, we've just been through, he's clearly saying, hey, Jesus is the new Moses. We don't get quite as clear a picture in Mark's Gospel. And he kind of actually takes us through a journey through his Gospel, unpacking some of Jesus' identity and through the different titles that people give him throughout his ministry. And so to explain those, we've just had Three questions that we asked of each of these boxes that you see on your sheet. So what is the title that Jesus was given, by whom, and what is its significance? So we'll go through each of these boxes in turn, if that's all right. So Mark, guys, people who went through the exercise, we'll start with box one, the one on the left. If I could have a few volunteers to talk us through how you would go about answering those three questions from those verses which are in those boxes. So what title is Jesus given, by whom, and what is its significance? Go on, Emma Boyle, you seem clear. Or someone else? Go on, Nenga, go on. Sorry? Great, yeah, Son of God, you can write that in the top, Son of God. Who is he given it by? Yes, yeah. So there we have, like, he's given it by three, actually, outsiders. So Mark, the demons, the unclean spirits, and also the centurion at the end. All of them outsiders to the people of Israel seem to give him this title. You started talking about Samuel 2, so explore some of the significance. What would people have understood by this phrase, Son of God, particularly with that Samuel 2 passage in mind? Either Nenge or someone else. What did you glean from that passage? I suppose it might be helpful to explore what's the type of thing that you think, if I was to say the Son of God, what do we have in mind? I wonder whether we often just think about the second person of the Trinity. So this is Mark saying that Jesus is, he's divine. Not quite, not with this title. If you read through that 2 Samuel passage, who's that? Like, someone explain it for the guys that, the Matthew guys that didn't go through it. Can someone just explain what's going on in that passage?
I think Nathan's giving David a promise from what he heard from God.
Yes. So we got the prophet Nathan giving a prophecy to David, a promise about the future kingdom. Interestingly, key verse 14, God says through Nathan, I will be his father and he shall be my son. This person that will inherit David's kingdom. And so the significance, I think, for this title for us is not necessarily that Mark here is not that people would have understood this phrase, Son of God, to mean second person of the Trinity. Actually, it would have been, this is someone that's inheriting the kingdom. This is someone in David's line. Did you get that link between the two verses? Okay, great. I'm seeing some silent nods. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. So that's the key thing for us from this passage. This phrase, the Son of God, would have meant for these guys, so this is the guy sent of God, sent from God. He is the one who's going to take on these promises that were given to him. Anything else that anyone wants to say from that box? If not, we will move on. Wonderful. Let's go to box two. All right. Box two. What's the title?
Son of Man.
Son of Man. Who uses it? Jesus, lots and lots and lots and lots, right? Yeah. Jesus just keeps on referring to himself as the Son of Man. What do you think the significance of this phrase is? What do you think Jesus is referring to when he talks about Son of Man?
He's trying to, although it's not like implicit, he's trying to point to the people, because obviously they would know from their scriptures about what they've read of Daniel.
Yeah.
So he was trying to point towards who Daniel saw in his vision and who he is. And
yeah.
So he's quite often calling himself Son of Man and not Son of God. It's people who were calling him Son of God earlier.
Mm.
So to himself he kept saying Son of Man, Son of Man.
Yes. So it seems to be a title that he really takes on for himself. I am the Son of Man. Now in one way, so if you read through particularly the Old Testament book of Ezekiel, this phrase Son of Man, Ezekiel uses it for himself. Basically just saying human. I am man, I am Son of God. If you know Narnia, you know all the guys are called sons of Adam, daughters of Eve. Like it's a similar phrase, I'm human. But we do have this really intriguing passage in Daniel 7, which hopefully you guys got to explore a bit. Someone talk us through that passage, like what's going on in that. So it's a prophecy from Daniel, but what's he talking about? What's he pointing us towards?
He's basically saying that he sees a vision and there's
Yeah.
It's kind of different from what Matthew's saying, that it's not just a Jewish thing, it's kind of, it's everybody.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there seems to be a real stepping back, kind of like a more of a global picture, absolutely. For you guys in Matthew who probably wouldn't have read this passage, it's kind of like a courtroom scene. So it's a heavenly courtroom, and you've got this character, the Son of Man, coming on clouds before God, seeming to represent someone who's maybe Israel or someone who comes on behalf of Israel. So kind of a Messiah figure within this passage. And this Son of Man enters the courtroom in the clouds, clouds of heaven. That's a really key phrase for us. The kind of the clouds are often associated with theophanies. Is that, if I pronounce that right? Theophany, thank you, you do the math. So that's basically displays of God's glory. Like we instantly think, okay, this is talking about something really, really significant. So in terms of Jesus taking on this title for himself, what's some of the significance that he's trying to draw out from it? Did you guys delve into that at all? Yes, yeah. I like that dual use of titles in Mark's gospel. We'll get to that and we'll look at that more explicitly in just a moment, kind of how these titles do two things. One is not only identity, but also thinking, what is this guy come to do? And particularly the cross is really key for Mark's gospel. I think what's interesting about this use of Son of Man, particularly for Jesus in Mark's gospel, what he's pointing us towards, is taking on some of that sort of quasi-divine thing that seemed to be associated with this Son of Man. So by the time we get to first century Palestine, this phrase Son of Man, it seems to have lost just simply its connotations of being, hey, I'm just some guy, but actually holds something of this, there's something more to who this guy is. There's something more about being... about this guy, maybe something even divine about him. Did any of you guys look particularly at the Mark 14 passage? Did any of you get there? Mark 14, 61 to 64. Let's have a look at that together. That will really help you guys get together. So if you have Bibles, just turn to those few verses and let's just think about those, because I think it will help unpack this. So this is Jesus' trial. So he's just he's before Caiaphas and he's basically being grilled. And the question that that Caiaphas asked, but Jesus remained silent, gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "Why do you need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him as worthy of death. What's interesting here is that it seems that Caiaphas, though, the high priests and those teachers of the law in this, they seem to have identified, Jesus is claiming not just to be a guy, he's not just a son of Adam in this place by using Son of Man. Actually, he's claiming something far more worthy of death. They recognize the blasphemy in the title that Jesus has taken on for himself. That's the significance for us from there. Let's turn our attention then to the third box. So if you... all right. What's this one? Son of David. Great. Who gives him this title?
Blind Bartimaeus.
Blind Bartimaeus. What a character. Yeah, Blind Bartimaeus. Anyone else?
David in his poems.
Sorry?
So David himself has in his poems.
Poems.
Psalms, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. David himself. Jesus takes it on for himself as well. It's the teachers of the law give him this phrase. Give him this name as well. So if you looked at the Mark 12 passage, which we'll look at just now, he says, look, why did the teacher of the law say that Messiah is the son of David? The title. Now, so if you do have a Bible worth looking at this Mark 12 passage, this is a really cool one to get in and tease out. So Mark 12, 35 to 37. What's it about, guys? What's its significance? Why would Jesus point to this? And kind of what's his point? Did anyone think about that? Go on, John. Yes, yeah. Great. Any other points people want to Drought, that was a great answer. Any other things people looked at? I think you pretty much nailed it, John. In terms of, like, David seems to... Jesus, by quoting David here, is kind of looking at this phrase, what does the son of David really mean? He's unpacking what people would have understood by it. So people, son of David, I think would have associated it very much with the son of God, that first identity that we did. So rather than, remember, son of God, not about second person of the Trinity at this stage, but it's about being sent of God, so here's Messiah. Here Jesus again is unpacking a bit of what that really means. What does it look like for Jesus to be the Messiah? That's what Mark's pointing us our attention to. And this story himself, Jesus seems to be saying, David looked at this, looked at who, like the Messiah that was to come. And did you see that? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under my feet. There's seems to be an elevation of whoever this son of David is, this Messiah will be. You would have thought in this time, particularly if you were passing on to generations, you have lesser sons, so always the father's the greater one. Whereas Jesus is pointing our attention to the fact that, hey, even David saw, hey, this, whoever's coming, the Messiah, is going to be one greater than me. You guys are looking for just another replica. You're looking for another David, someone who will fight with armies and swords. Jesus here is saying, no. It's going to be something greater, something bigger. Again, he's raising our expectations. So very similar to the way that we saw Mark dealing with the Son of Man and kind of drawing out that theme of, okay, this is whoever this is something more than just a man, something more than just like an earthly captain of armies. Do you see that? How Mark is teasing these out? Thanks for nodding. Go on. I think it's still important for us to understand Jesus within his Jewishness. I suppose when we're saying that Mark is writing to Gentiles, he explains these things and pointing us towards those right answers. So he's using them, but helping us think, okay, what do these really mean? If that helps. So, like, Jesus was a Jew, he has to look at Jesus in his Jewishness. But I think what Mark is doing here is just helping us explore a bit of that. Does that make sense? You don't look convinced.
Can I point out?
He never looks convinced.
Says the husband, like it. Yeah. Go on, Elizabeth.
So is it saying that if he had been writing to a Jewish audience, then to say someone's the son of David, they just have got it, so we wouldn't need to explain it. Whereas because he's writing to a Gentile audience, he bothers to go into the explanation because they need it.
No, I think with Jesus saying this riddle, one of the things that he's doing is, like, to his audience. So he said this to Jews. So he was saying, hey, this son of David that you're waiting for, hey, it's something more. So that's what he's...
But that's what he's doing there. Mark's chosen to include that explanation.
Yeah.
Whereas Matthew hasn't. Because Mark knows that the...
I don't know, is this quoted in Matthew's Gospel?
No. I think...
Go on.
I think I would say that... Whilst it's helpful to say that Matthew wrote for a Jewish audience and Mark for a Gentile audience, that's not to say that either of them only wrote the things that were only relevant to that audience. So both of them are faithfully telling what happened to Jesus. So Mark is not writing something that could be read by anyone without any reference to Judaism. I mean, he still wants people to know that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, the representative of Israel. I mean, that's what the Son of Man in Daniel 7 is. So he's not shying away from the Jewishness at all. I think arguably, actually, he leaves it quite cryptic in that Mark 12 bit, because that's a bit of a baffling passage, which I think Andy's done a good job of explaining, but it's a confusing one, whether you're Jewish or Gentile, to be honest, because it would have challenged everyone's views, and even the Jewish readers probably would have gone, oh, wow, hey, that's a baffling claim, what is going on there? And yeah, I don't understand Psalm 110 either, so it's complex, and I think the Jewish-Gentile thing could confuse us more than it's helpful, so I'd almost shelve that and say, what is the particular reason for Mark using these three terms? And I think there's something that's going on in Mark, irrespective of the Jewish or Gentile audience. I think Mark is often described as an apocalyptic gospel. That is, the word apocalypsis means to do with revelation, like the drawing back of a curtain. and I hope I'm not trampling on you.
No, you go for it. No, let.
And I think that's what Mark is doing for whatever audience. It just happens to be he's probably writing for Gentiles. It's like he's pulling back this curtain so that you can see with increasing measure who Jesus is. And so he starts out by showing us Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. And you may wonder what the Jewish Messiah has as any relevance to us as Gentiles. Well, let me pull it back a little bit more, and you see that this Jewish Messiah is actually the Lord of all creation, all the nations bow down to him. And let's pull this out a bit further, and you see that this guy is not simply a king like David, like people were used to, but actually there's something almost divine about him. And as he's bringing back the curtain wider, you're seeing, oh wow, he's more than just a man, he's more than just a Jewish man, he is the, you know, the man, he is the representative of God who combines all these different elements and therefore is relevant for me, you know, whatever my background. So does that help a little bit?
Yeah.
Great.
Thanks. One answer I had to tag in, right? Take that one.
Basically, great. I kept all my material out of the notes, all the best answers. I can just sort of dip in and just go, well, let me explain what I did.
Yep. It is. Yeah. Yeah. Is that helpful? Maybe it's helpful to explore a bit of how Mark does that in his gospel. So the kind of the drawing back of the curtain, this unveiling of Jesus' identity. So if you do want to turn over to the next page, we'll go through this and just explore some of the themes that are in Mark's gospel. So the thing is, through these exercises that we've just done, so those three boxes, hopefully you would have seen that Mark is clearly pointing us towards Jesus' messianic identity through these titles. He does want to help us to see Jesus as Israel's Messiah, so the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Son of David. But he's also pointing us towards the function that the Messiah was to have. So through these titles, but also the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus, Mark is really subverting what the original hearers would have considered the Messiah to be all about. And I think Mark really takes us on a journey through his gospel, not only unpacking his identity, but doing this, what has he come to do? And I do love this, because I think it sort of seems to mirror something of Peter's own journey. So if you think this is his account of Jesus, it sort of mirrors his grasping aspects of who Jesus is and what he comes to do until we finally get to the end and the climax of the gospel in its passion narrative. But let's go through this. So if you were to sit down and sort of just read Mark's gospel, there is a watershed moment that I think you get to, and it's difficult really not to spot, and it's Peter's confession of Jesus in Mark 8:27-30. And I think I found it very helpful to think of these verses a bit like the hinge that Mark's gospel sort of revolves around. So chapters 1 to 8 seem to be a section in Mark's gospel building up to this point, and then from chapter 8 onwards seem to be unpacking the point of Jesus being the Christ and what that really means. So those first 8 chapters of Mark's gospel really focuses on Jesus' activity and his ministry in and around Galilee. So that was an area in northern Israel, kind of where we grew up. And this section of Mark's gospel, filled with healings and miracles and exorcisms, it seems that Mark here is really drawing our attention to Jesus's authority and how he demonstrates that over sickness, in teaching, over the Sabbath, over evil spirits, over nature, and even over death. Mark, as well, really seems to highlight and emphasize the pace of Jesus' ministry. So if you were to read through it, it's just filled with words like immediately or suddenly. So on the handout, it's used 42 times in Mark's gospel. Compare that with 7 in Luke or 4 in John. There's a pace around this. Mark is wanting us to see Jesus as someone who's rushing around healing, teaching, and doing lots and lots of things. These are the reasons that we associate Mark's gospel with the lion. Do you know those four animals we looked at? The lion. So it's associated with power and authority, with action and activity. And it's in this manner that Peter builds towards Peter's confession in Mark 8. And it's a huge moment and massively significant for Mark's gospel. So if you do have a Bible, turn with these verses. Let's just have a look at those. So Mark 8, 27-30. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi, and on the way asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Jesus answered, "You are the Christ." And I think in these verses, it's kind of like Mark's pointing us, oh, these disciples have finally got it. They finally got Jesus' identity. But the verses that come just after this confession are really telling. Let me read from until verse 34. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And then he called the crowd to him among the disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me." And the pattern that we see across these verses, so Jesus predicting his death, the disciples' misunderstanding, and then Jesus teaching on the cost of discipleship, which is ultimately modelled on his own suffering on the cross, the ultimate fulfilment of it. This pattern not only happens in Mark 8, but also then 9 and 10. And it's in this pattern that Mark is pointing us towards the work of the Messiah. What is Jesus come to do? What is the Messiah all about? And he's basically pointing us towards how significant the cross is. And this is really important for the disciples, because it seems like most of their contemporaries, they had a very different idea to Jesus, to what his role on earth would be. The disciples seem to be waiting for a political Messiah, that is someone who would take the fight to Rome with armies. And for the Messiah to suffer and die is alien to this hope and alien to what this idea of what the kingdom of God looked like. They thought the Messiah was to reign on a throne in Jerusalem and instigate a great time of peace and prosperity for God's people in Israel. I think correcting this misunderstanding is the focus of the whole second half of Mark's gospel. He shows us that he has a very different idea. Jesus had a very different idea to his disciples. He's focusing on Jesus' journey towards Jerusalem, so his confrontation with that city, with the authorities within it, but also then his death on the cross. And the last week of Jesus' life received such prominence in Mark's gospel that particularly one biblical scholar, a German named Martin Kähler, described Mark's gospel as a passion narrative with an extended introduction. And within this passion narrative, Mark isn't just pointing us towards Jesus' trial and death, but also he's teaching about the new covenant, so all the new things that he's doing. What is this kingdom really going to look like? So, e.g. the Lord's Supper and things like that. And there are loads more that could be said along this theme. So Jesus confronting the temple and all those. So much so that we will actually dedicate whole sessions to those, because they're really important to understand the title. But I think I've way run out of time, right? But anyway, so let me summarise in terms of what we've come to in terms of looking at who is the Christ in Mark's Gospel and what has he come to do. So who is the Christ? So it's Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Son of David. And what has he come to do? It's to bring about a new covenant as he dies on the cross, that we could know forgiveness of sins, see who Jesus truly is, and to know intimate relationship with God himself. So that's it from Mark's Gospel for now, but we'd love to open up for Q&A for anything that you've had in terms of for Matthew or for Mark. Is that right?
Yeah.
Great, if we've got some time. Let me pass this over to you as you go.
Yeah, you can do that, but it looks like the questions are coming on the Mark side, so I'll pass it straight back to you in a second. Yeah, go for it.
Did he ever explicitly say he was the Son of God?
Okay, so the question is, let me just tease out exactly what the question is. Is the question, did Jesus ever claim to be the Son of God, or did he claim to be God? Because that's the C.S. Lewis point, isn't it, that he claimed to be God?
Either.
Okay, well, I think there's an important distinction. So, as Andy said, we hear Son of God and we think Trinity, Father, Son, Spirit. So, therefore, Son of God means second person of the Trinity. And I just don't think that's what they were thinking when they heard the phrase Son of God. So, Son of God in 2 Samuel 7 means a messianic figure who would be a king like David. And probably they wouldn't have thought of that as being a divine thing at all. So, the claim to be Son of God is not actually... Well, it is controversial because you're claiming to be the king, but you're not claiming to be divine. So there's that. I'd say the Son of Man, paradoxically, sounds more human, doesn't it, than Son of God? I think actually they went the other way around. So when Jesus in that Mark 14 passage is standing before the high priest and he said, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the living God?" He just means, "Are you the earthly ruler? Are you the Messiah?" And Jesus said, "I am." So there's your answer to the claim. He did claim to be there. And you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. And you think, oh, hang on, wait a minute. You said yes. And then you just upped the game and you said, and I am this quasi-divine figure in Daniel 7. It's implicit there. And actually, I would have a bit of a... Yeah, I don't know. I'd quibble a little bit with this. There's a C.S. Lewis quote where it talks about the forgiveness of sin and says that Jesus claims to forgive sin, and that's an absurd thing to do unless you are the one who has sinned against, and therefore that's an implicit claim of Jesus to say he's God. And I think that's kind of true, but it's also kind of not, because the priests all the time said, you are forgiven, and they did it on behalf of God. So actually, I think the claim to forgive sin may just mean that Jesus saw himself as taking the place of the priesthood. So I would quibble a little bit with C.S. Lewis on that. Did Jesus claim to be God? I think absolutely, definitely he did. And people certainly understood him to be claiming to be God because they wanted to kill him, and they called it blasphemy. And in various points in the Gospels it says, and they tried to stone him because they thought that he, a very man, was claiming to be God. And so he certainly, definitely did claim to be God, and people understood that because there were such repercussions of it. But I think we just need to separate, which is I think what Andy was getting at, is we need to separate out the idea of Son of God from divine figure. And when we get to John's Gospel next week, maybe we'll see a few more explicit ways in which Jesus did, I think, claim to be God. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah.
Sorry, it was slightly long, long answer to that question, but okay.
Interesting. There are a number of things in Mark's gospel in the first eight chapters as well. So those areas that he had authority over, they would have all been indicators of. So you know, he calms the storm, and the disciples goes, "Who is this that even the winds and the waves obey him?" There are things locked in those as well that would help people go, "Ah, oh, he's more than just some dude." Yeah.
Yep. Okay, yeah. So the C.S. Lewis argument is... Andy's just bored. The C.S. Lewis argument is... So I think it particularly comes in reference to the bit in Mark 4, I want to say, where Jesus gets... Jesus gets lowered through
Mark
the roof.
Two.
Mark 2, is it?
Yeah.
Thank you. Where the guy gets lowered through the roof for Jesus to be healed. And Jesus talks about... healing him, but also says, you know, which is it more difficult to do, to heal this guy or to say your sins are forgiven? And then he does both. and C.S. Lewis says that here, where Jesus is claiming to be able to forgive sins, what he is claiming to do is to be able to do what only God can do, and so therefore that's an implicit claim to be God. And I think, yes, I follow that. In fact, in the passage, people do seem to see that as a blasphemous claim, but actually the priests all the time would say, you are forgiven, and they would declare forgiveness. But the reason they would do that is not because they were the ones that were being wronged, but because they, as the mediators between God and man, had that particular role of saying, I declare that your sins are forgiven against this God on the basis of this sacrifice. I think that actually when Jesus claims to be forgiving sins, he may be claiming to be God, but I think more than that, he's also claiming to be the mediator between man and God, who is possibly going to do away with the whole sacrificial system anyway. And that gets quite complex. And we will devote an entire session to the temple and the Son of Man and the Son of God and all that sort of stuff, because it's pretty mind-boggling. But to be clear, I think Jesus was God. And I think everyone thought that as well. Is God, yes, you're right. Sorry, grammar's getting me in trouble here today. Yes, amen. Okay, any other questions? Quickly. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could comment on the last part of Mark that's in italics in my Bible.
Mm.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the end of Mark. Oh, thank you. You've opened the page for me. Very helpful. Shall I answer this one, or do you want to?
You nail it. I mean, I've got it, but you go for it.
I want to call his bluff, but no. Okay, at the end of Mark, let's go for it. The end of Mark, then Mark 16, there's a little section which I think probably in everyone's Bibles, actually, will have at least a footnote saying some manuscripts do not contain this part. So there is some doubt over whether this was an authentic ending of Mark or not. And it's very hard to be certain either way on that. My take on it is that probably this was not an original part of Mark's gospel. And that's why virtually every Bible is honest about that and says, look, there is some doubt about this. And I respect that honesty because, you know, it opens up a lot of historical questions. I think probably the end of Mark was either lost or incomplete or something like that. If you lop off that bit in Mark 16, then the entire gospel ends by trembling and bewildered. The women went out and fled for the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Boom. Like the greatest ending to a book ever, isn't it? Yeah. That to me suggests that was just pretty rubbish ending. Like nearly as bad as the ending of Lost. So that's an ending of epic badness. So I think probably what happened is either the ending was lost or it was never completed or something like that. And so at some point in early church history, this end was created, maybe from eyewitness stories, maybe from a range of sources, and it was put on as a suitable end to Mark. Now, that raises a lot of questions about what you do with it. Would you preach from it? Would you build doctrine on it? Those sorts of things. And what I would say to that question, which I'm aware is not the question you asked, but one I just asked myself, is I think it's tricky. I think there is lots in this passage that sounds very similar to other stuff. And almost everything Jesus says there, I think, I don't have a problem with that because Jesus says that sort of stuff all over the place. So this could be very accurate, and I'm happy to believe this is accurate. But there are a few things in it that are slightly unusual and aren't found in Matthew's ending, for example, like the bit about snakes. They will bite you and you will not die, and drinking deadly poison and that sort of thing. And I think that's not anywhere else. That's not in Matthew's gospel. And so to me, personally, I think that feels like the early church kind of writing maybe something of their experience back into the ending of Mark. So, for example, there's the bit in... It's in Malta, isn't it, in Acts, yeah. where Paul is on the island, and yeah, the snakes start biting people and they don't die. Quite possibly what happened is that the early church took that story and maybe other similar stories and wrote it back into the end of Mark's gospel. I don't know. What I would say in terms of my own spiritual life and my doctrine and my preaching is that I would not build anything on this passage that I can't find anywhere else, because I have doubts about this passage. And so when you get entire church movements that are built on this one obscure verse that probably Mark never even wrote anyway, and they say, hey, let's all just handle live snakes, and you know, Jesus told us to, and I think, you fools, seriously, what are you doing? I have a snake here today if anyone would like to. Don't get me started on that. So I would not build doctrines on this passage that aren't corroborated from anywhere else. And personally, if I were wanting to preach on something in here like healing and signs and wonders, I would go somewhere that's far more secure to preach on that. That was another long-winded answer to a short question. Does that help?
I think, Liam, in one way, it does a bit of discredit to the end of Mark sometimes. Because I think there are some people who would say Mark leaves it on a cliffhanger. Like, there's a sense of what's next. And, like, it's deliberately wanting you to think, what's that kind of next thing, the birth of the church? It's not... Yeah, there's debate over it. But I quite like the way that Mark leaves it, just hanging. Just kind of, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, that is a possibility.
It's kind of,
yeah.
Like, what about you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wants the Hollywood sequel.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So that might be true as well.
Maybe another way of looking at it is, I'm an optimist, I like a happy ending. Andy's a pessimist, he's happy with a miserable ending. And that might be all there is to it. Okay, we are out of time. If you do have other questions, then please do come and ask me or Andy, preferably Andy. Next week we're going to look at Luke and John. You may want to look at...
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.